Today's Teisho will be on case 3 in the Book of Serenity, the invitation of the ancestor to Eastern India. Introduction, the state before the beginning of time. A turtle heads for the fire. The one phrase especially transmitted outside of doctrine, the lip of a mortar bears flowers. Now tell me, is there any accepting and withholding, reading and reciting in this case? A Raja of an East Indian country invited the 27th Buddhist ancestor, Prajnatara, to a feast. The Raja asked him, "Why don't you read your scriptures?" The ancestor said, "This poor wayfarer doesn't dwell in the realm of the body or mind when breathing in, doesn't get involved in myriad circumstances when breathing out. I always reiterate such a scripture, hundreds, thousands, millions of scrolls." Verse, a cloud rhino gazes at the moon, its light engulfing radiance. A wood horse jumps in spring, swift and unbridled. Under the eyebrows, a pair of cold blue eyes. How can reading scriptures reach the piercing of oxhide? The clear mind produces vast aeons. Heroic power smashes the double enclosure. In the subtle round mouth of the pivot turns the spiritual works. Han Shan forgot the road by which he came. Sherda led him back by the hand. Thank you all for making such an excellent effort this morning. this is the last day of our sesshin, and it's a beautiful day. For the first 5 years, something like that, when I started doing Zen with Genki Roshi, basically around day 3, maybe day 4, I would suddenly realize it's day 4, one more day, right? And I would think, you know, I've just got to make it. You know, I get up on day 5, like, day 5, you know, I just got to make it one more day. And I'd get up at 4:30 and I'd think, tomorrow, boy, I'm sleeping in. How sweet it will be, you know. You go through a change. You definitely go through a change. It's like, you know, I actually feel sad when I think, oh my God, sesshin is ending. I'm serious. It's always sort of a bummer. I don't know if people say that anymore, but it's sad, you know. It's like, oh no, it's already day 4 or day, you know, whatever, you know. So definitely their time will come if you continue to practice when you actually think, oh no, it's almost over, you know. This is so wonderful. Sesshin is so wonderful. It is. It's absolutely wonderful. And, you know, just as I've done a fair amount of things. I've been a cook. I've been a moving man. I've been a carpenter. Traveled around. I haven't been everywhere, but I've been to a few places. I've done some interesting things. And there's nothing in the world like this. I just think this is absolutely the coolest thing in the universe. And when I'm here, I am in heaven. I mean, I'm also in heaven in my job. But you know, there's something really special about sesshin. I love this freedom. This freedom. You know, like everybody else, I come here. I have my own, you know, things, my own BS. You know, I come here, and on day 1, you know, I'm just focusing on getting the sesshin up and running, and then You know, day two, I'm thinking of all the stuff I have to deal with, you know, and I'm, or evening of day one, and day two in the morning, I'm still thinking of all this stuff I have to do. You know, by around the end of day two, it's all becoming very remote. And, you know, around day three, if you hang in there, you know, basically it's like a switch goes on. Something changes around day three or day four. It's like people have some kind of real cognitive change. And you suddenly feel so much, I mean, generally speaking, suddenly feel so much better. It may not be the case that you've had this experience yet, but if you haven't, you will. You know, you'll definitely come to a session, and around day three, you'll think, "Oh, this is so much better. I don't know what just happened to me, but all of a sudden, it's like the clouds have parted and the sky is clear in all directions." You know, that's how you sort of feel. And I love that experience. I absolutely love it. And, you know, the truth is that it's rather predictable. You know, if you just practice, you go through this process where, you know, day one, you're thinking about your stuff. Day two, maybe a little bit, but you're also getting tired. Day three or day four, everything starts to clear up. You know, you begin to be able to sit in real simplicity. You know, instead of having all these thoughts, you're able to be in an empty mental state, just watching your breath or calling Mu or working with your koan. And everything is very, very simple by around day three or day four. And that is really like a very unique state, you know, very precious and so unusual, right? To have that kind of, we've been meditating for 8 hours a day, right? So by about the third or fourth day, your mind is in this luminous, open, uncluttered, unattached, and no longer projecting state. And this is, the more you do this, the more precious that is going to seem to you, the more extraordinary it is. And that's where people make their breakthroughs. And then, you know, if you keep practicing, you know, definitely by around day five, you're going to find, I don't know about you, but I really couldn't sleep last night. I had so much energy when I went to bed. You know, I woke up around three and I thought, uh-oh, I'm not going to be able to sleep. And I sort of tried to go to sleep, but I just, you know, you will eventually have so much energy. And I know that there was a Roshi I know who I'd been to a couple sessions with him, and I know that he would just spend the last couple nights of session staying up all night reading like detective novels, because, you know, he was so used to not being able to sleep. So I'd say good night, he'd say okay, and he was going off with some novel. He said, I can't wait to get into this new novel, you know. So that really was true, you know. So eventually, you know, instead of freaking out about it, oh my God, I can't sleep, it's like he would, you know, spend the night with, I don't know who. But anyway, you know, that will happen. The other thing that will happen is, you know, around this time, if you keep practicing, when Sesshin starts, you know, first day, it's okay. Second day, suddenly, you know, like a half an hour sit feels like a long time, right? It's like, you know, suddenly a half hour becomes, it seems to elongate, gets longer. But, you know, by the end of Sesshin, if you keep practicing, half an hour is like that. You know, I don't know if you noticed, but you know, the first sit today was 45 minutes, and I didn't mean to do that. It's just, I sat down, I'm watching the breath, and I thought, oh my God, what time is it? You know, it's like, uh-oh, you know, so you ring the bell. And this is nothing, I'm not telling you, I'm not boasting, I'm not saying, oh boy, you know, everybody I know who's practiced for a long time, really diligently, could tell you these same things, right? It's just like, on day one, I said the human being is like an iPhone that's used as a doorstop by our society. So, you know, basically, we have all of these amazing, I mean, from the Buddhist standpoint, we are a little device that was made for enlightenment. And instead of pursuing enlightenment, people pursue all these kinds of, you know, they, you could say, spend their lives, you know, acquiring things that they don't really care about very much. Basically, you know, a lot of people, you know, at the end of their lives just say, well, what was it all about, you know? I remember when I was growing up, my mother used to listen to this song that I just hated, and it was, she was just there, look, she had, you know, she had, my parents had gotten divorced, etc., and my mother would listen to this song, and it was, you know, the lines were, is that all there is to life? Well, if that's all there is to life, let's keep dancing, you know? And it was really like a sad song. It's like, so, life, there's nothing to life, you know? Screw it, you know, let's just dance, you know? And it was, and that's all there is? Then that's all there is, you know? And it was like, oh, Mom, please, you know? It doesn't have to be like that, right? You know, so one of the things that I think is so amazing about Zen is that you're discovering your apps, you know? Really, it's like you suddenly realize, oh my gosh, you know, there's like this energy pack, there's this energy center in my navel, you know? I remember once meditating and just feeling like this incredible heat coming from my dantian, my hara, you know? And I thought, this can't be happening, you know, this is bullshit, you know, this can't. But it was like, oh my God, and I went in to, and I saw Genki Roshi, and I said, Genki Roshi, it's like, and he just laughed, you know. So, little by little, you know, you realize, you sit down on the cushion and you disappear. You know, if you've ever been working with the Mukong, sometimes it just seems like absolutely everything disappears. And, you know, one could go on and on, but the, you know, I mentioned earlier in the session, you know, the Dalai Lama said the goal of Buddhism is a complete transformation of the human being. And another way to put it is the goal of Buddhism is the complete activation of the human being. And I definitely think that's what this is all about. It's like discovering our unused lost apps so that we become the fully functional Buddha beings that we really are. And for me, Sesshin is always interesting and precious because, you know, it's definitely the case that, you know, I find another app or helping somebody else operate an undiscovered app is really a great, great thing for me, really wonderful and exciting. So we're all sort of iPhones trying to learn. We don't have the instruction manual. People have given us a lot of bad information about what to do, and now we're trying to figure it out, you know. And this is a wonderful opportunity, this session, to begin to find those apps and put them to use. I can't praise Sesshin highly enough. I just think it's so important, and I thank you so much for doing such an excellent job. On the other hand, you know, Sesshin is really challenging, and it's often the case that you know, it doesn't always end the way one wants it to end. You know, we don't always figure out by day 5 or day 7 of Sesshin what that app was all about, you know. And that can be a little disappointing, right? I have been through, I can't tell you how many Sesshins I've been through where, you know, we're coming to the end of the Sesshin and in my fantasy, in my mind, it's like, it's the bottom of the 9th inning, the bases are loaded, and Spellmeyer is coming up to bat. And damn it, he knocks it into the bleachers. You know? But what often happens instead is he comes up, he taps the plate, you know, and he strikes out. You know, and it's like the end, and they lose. The team loses. You know. So there are many, I have had many sesshins where that happened to me, where, you know, the story goes, you're supposed to be, you know, at the last Dokusan on the last day. I went in and I gave him the answer. And he said, that is great, excellent. You know, here's your new koan. You know, you drive home thinking, ah, I've really done it, you know. But many sesshins, that has not happened, right? And that's part of the learning process, you know. It doesn't have to be a bitter pill if you think about, you know, basically this is an ongoing process of waking up, you know. You know, the worst thing a Zen teacher can do is give you a koan you quickly resolve. So, you know, I've had that experience. You know, I've had students, and I have students, you know, who I'll give them a koan, and then, you know, it's not always the case, but sometimes they come in and they've got an answer, and it's an acceptable answer. And then I give them another one, and it's an acceptable answer. And sometimes I feel like, well, this is a problem, right? So, you know, I recently gave somebody a koan, and they were having a really hard time. And they said, I really feel stuck. It's like, thank God. Finally, you know? Sometimes people are on a roll, right? They're on a roll. They don't know how it's happening, but they're just answering their koans. That, you know, here's a koan, bing. It's like, how is this happening? And please don't think too much. So that can definitely happen, and when it happens, it's wonderful. But it's also the case that you know, the teacher is trying to get. Not much can be learned sometimes from having a koan that you can walk through quickly. You know, we learn the most from the koans that challenge our deepest assumptions or challenge our habitual ways of looking at the world. And naturally, those are the ones that are going to stick in our throat, you know. In the Mumonkan, Master Mumon says, you know, working on a koan is like, he says, this is not a very inviting metaphor, but he says it's like swallowing a red-hot iron ball. You can't swallow it, but you can't spit it out, right? It sounds fun, right? Sounds like fun. But he means that the koans that really make us activated require some require some difficulty. And I myself have had koans where, you know, I've talked about this before, but there was one koan that I literally was hopping mad, you know, and not when I didn't answer, but when I answered it. You know, I was working on this koan, and I realized, is that the answer? And I went in to see Genki Roshi, and I said, you know, blah, 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 and he said, exactly. I thought, this is the biggest bunch of bullshit, you know. I literally came out of that room thinking, Zen is a, I felt like screaming, Zen is a fraud, you know. But the koan took me to a place I didn't want to be. It showed me something about myself that I did not want to see, you know. And it was so hard for me. Not some koans are not showing you something about yourself that you don't want to see, but in this case, the koan was showing me something about myself I didn't want to see, and I fought it every step of the way. And when I finally saw that, you know, it just made me furious. And later, I could laugh about it, you know. But at the time, I literally was just fuming. I just, this is a ripoff, you know, this is. So, you know, koan training is challenging for good reason. I mean, if you go out over there on the property, you'll see there's a maze. If enlightenment was as simple as walking outside, and walking, following the stones in the maze to the center, what a wonderful world it would be, you know. But that is really not a practice that is going to be liberating. No matter how many times you walk that maze, I have to say it, you know. That's not challenging your understanding of the world. That's not going to activate your apps. You know, people who do Zen have a great deal of courage. You know, they're willing not just to sit for 8 hours a day, but they're willing to go into those parts of themselves they might not want to confront, you know, and that takes great courage, you know, and so you all have demonstrated that courage here. It's also the case that sometimes with our koan practice, we're not approaching it the right way, you know. So in this case, for example, this is the story of a great, one of the ancestors of Zen. So if you don't know much about Zen, after the Buddha his successor was a person named Mahakashapa, okay? And then Ananda and so on. So when the Buddha died, he had sort of like successors, people who sort of carried on some of his teaching responsibilities. And there's this idea in Zen that each of these teachers has passed on authorization to teach. So those are the ancestors, okay? And it's not based upon, let me go to the koan. In this case, a Raja in East India somewhere, according to the koan, invited this great Buddhist master named Prajnatara to come and give a lecture on the scriptures, on the Buddhist scriptures. And there are Buddhist scriptures. In fact, there's a huge number of Buddhist scriptures. Western religion, you know, you have Torah and Talmud, you have the Bible, you have the Quran, right? And they're all these fairly, even though they're fairly thick, you know, there's one book. But in Buddhist tradition, there's like huge library. You could never exhaust it, you know. And so there's this giant library of materials. And so there's plenty to read in Buddhism, plenty to study. And so the Raja says, we'd like you to come and have you lecture on maybe the Lankavatara Sutra, your school's particular sutra. And the ancestor comes and he says, listen, you know, this poor wayfarer doesn't, you know, I'm not going to lecture to you on the sutras. I'm going to talk about what actually happens when I sit down on the cushion and meditate. So he says, this poor wayfarer doesn't dwell in the realms of the body or mind when breathing in, and doesn't get involved in myriad circumstances when breathing out. That's the scripture I recite. See, and I have recited it hundreds, thousands, and millions of times. So the point is, you know, it's very important to read the sutra. So I urge everybody here to read, say, the Diamond Sutra, or the Heart Sutra, or the Platform Sutra, the story of Wei Nang, if you want to, or the Lankavatara Sutra, if you feel like being continuously frustrated and baffled. But nevertheless, you know, the foundation of Zen is practice on the cushion, is immediate experience. So it's very difficult for people, even if they've been practicing for 10 years or even longer, not to begin to intellectualize when you're given a koan, you know. If you're given a koan, you know, you sit with it in a blank mind, and so if your koan is, it's not the flag that moves, it's not the wind that moves, it's your mind that moves. You sit there and enter mushin, and you say, moves, 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 moves. And You know, you probably know that you shouldn't be interpreting the koan intellectually. So, you know, if you know anything about Buddhist philosophy, you could probably come up with an explanation for the story. But you know that isn't going to be the answer to the koan. So you go into blank mind and you focus on moves. And the way koans work is that there is supposed, the koans are like a little like a mantra. You know, so when you go into blank mind and you say moves, it's like you're giving your big mind a question or a something to work with. And your big mind at first doesn't seem to be doing anything with it, but eventually it's going to start responding to this, okay? So you know, the way to answer a koan is not to try to figure it out intellectually, but to trust the big mind to produce an answer. And you're going to be processing at a level that's not necessarily visible to you, okay? So earlier in this session, I said that the mind is like, you know, the unconscious mind is like the bottom of the iceberg, and the conscious mind is the tip of the iceberg, and that we live ordinarily at the tip of the iceberg, and we don't even know there's anything under the surface of the water. Well, you know, when you are working on the mu koan, you're learning how to find what's under the surface, you know. So people who are working on the mu koan are trying to activate their big mind. You know, when you call mu and you're entering that blankness, when you enter that blankness for the first time, you're really looking at the big mind. And the more you spend time facing that blankness, the deeper your meditation becomes and the closer you come to this door to your unconscious mind. And when you've answered mu, that door has opened up a little bit, and the energy of the unconscious has filled your lungs and called mu in the kitchen. And basically, I'm listening to hear if you can get out of your own way, and if I can hear the voice of your unconscious in your calling. So, you know, if I hear too much self-consciousness, then I know probably back to the cushion. If I hear sort of tentativeness, some people hold on too tightly to themselves. They don't really trust the process. All of those are reasons for saying no. But if a person can really let go and let this energy flow through her or him, then that is the passing of the koan. And that means something has changed in you. You might not necessarily feel you're any different, but you've had an experience where you've actually activated that energy. And then, you know, after that, the koans are like learning how to use your mu power, learning how to use that intelligence, that deeper mind, to re-see the world in a different way. So, you know, after mu, the teacher gives you a new koan, and it's really saying, okay, now you know how to get to that blankness. You know how to open yourself up to that blankness. Now, use those abilities, use those apps to re-see something that you thought was this way, but it's a different way. So when you take the koan's turning phrase into your being, when you say something like moves, it's like throwing a magic stone into a well, right? And the well sink, you can see the stone going through the water a little bit, and then it just drops out of sight because the well is so deep. And you just see it heading down through the water into the darkness. And then you just sit there looking into the well, and nothing seems to be happening. So, you know, a days could go by where you're sitting on the cushion calling moves and nothing seems to be happening. But sooner or later, something is going to start floating up to the surface of the well. And you just have to be attentive for these unconscious or subconscious responses. And sometimes they take the form of a thought or an idea or an image. Sometimes they take other forms. There are some koans that require you to do a certain thing, act in a certain way. So this could sound crazy, but actually, it's very interesting. The koan collection we use, the Mumonkan, was written in the 7th century. So, there are some koans that require particular answers or particular gestures even. And this was written in the 7th century in a different civilization. But if I give you the koan, eventually you'll give the right answer. And I'll leave you to think about how that's possible. But you're definitely learning how to use your big mind. Learning how to activate your big mind. Now, one of the things that happens to people is, while you're sitting there looking into the well, waiting for something to come up, you can have all these doubts. You can say, oh boy, no, I knew it. It's never going to happen for me. He said this would work, but it's never going to work. That could happen, other things can happen. It's actually very purifying to just sit there looking into the well, waiting for the answer. You can work through a lot of your obstacles just doing that. So if you're an angry person, you're likely to feel anger. If you're an impatient person, you're likely to have feelings of impatience. And little by little, you sort of work through all that. So just going through that process is purifying. But then, eventually something starts bubbling up. And then there's, you may not understand what's happening. It's very common in the early part of Zen practice for you not to understand why you answered the koan. So, people come in sometimes and they'll say something that is absolutely the right answer. And so I'll say, great, that's wonderful. And they have no idea why it's the right answer, right? So that is fantastic, it's right on the money. And they go away as confused as before. That's going to be the case. Just be happy you got the right answer. But eventually, it all fits together. There's a famous parable in one of the sutras where the Buddha said, reality, we experience reality in little pieces. So this is the famous blind man and the elephant, right? The one blind man grabs the trunk and says an elephant is like a snake. Another one grabs its leg and says it's like a tree, and so on. So you could think of koan training as like the elephant, right? Getting to know the elephant. So you're getting to know the trunk, you're getting to know the ear, little by little, it's going to all fit together into an elephant. But that's down the road. For now, let's just take one little piece, right? So you might not understand why this is a good answer. But it will definitely make sense to you later, I promise. And there's definitely, there's not exactly, there's, koans are supposed to activate your big mind. And so there's not like a book somewhere that has exactly the right answer, but it is supposed to do certain things. So koan will trigger certain responses. And it's definitely the case that some responses are more fully realized than other responses. So if you come in and you say to the teacher, it might be, you're just out in left field, it's so far from home plate, there's no hope, So then I will just say, I think you're going in the wrong direction. Or I think you need to go back to the cushion. But sometimes the answer is it's close. So I might say, can you go back and refine this a little bit? You know, please, I think you're there, but I'd like to see more precision or something like that. And you'll go back and sit some more and come in, and often people have better answer. You know, so this is like learning. It's like you have a sixth sense. You have this deeper intelligence, and we don't know how to access it. But we're learning how to access it. Koan training is the way that's done. It's often the case that people working with a koan, as you're waiting for things to come out of the well, people begin to get nervous, as I said. They might get angry, they might distrust themselves, they get frustrated, all those things. When something comes up, you know, people don't always recognize it as the answer. So people will come into Dokusan and I'll say, what's happening on the cushion? Nothing. Nothing's happening today. Really? Nothing? But you've been sitting so well. You know, no, nothing, no answer. And then I'll say, well, tell me what's happening. Just what's floating up? And I'll say, oh, blah, blah, blah. And it's the answer, right? But they didn't know. You know, they thought, oh, that's not important. You know, I'm looking for something else, you know. And then I'll say, well, you know, actually that's the answer. So you're not necessarily ready to recognize what's coming up as the answer, you know. It's just think of the blind man and the elephant. But gradually, you know, you get better and better at this, you know. I know people who, you know, basically... you know, Genki Roshi was really famous at Myo Shinji because he'd do it like a koan a day, you know, just like bing, 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 bing. You know, he once told me he did like 12 it was like, I would spend like a year on a koan, right? And Genki Roshi once said, yeah, that was the time I answered 12 koans in one session, and he's laughing, you know. It's like, well, then it'll take me 150 years, right, you know. At that rate, you know, at my rate, I'll never do that, you know. So, you know, but you in Zen, we use a metaphor, the Dharma eye. Your Dharma eye is open. And what that really means is that, you know, you learn how to trust your bigger mind. You learn how to trust it. You learn how to use it. You know, earlier in the session, I talked about getting out of your way. You know, if we're working on a koan and we're too obsessed with getting the right answer, you know, the worst thing you have to try, but then you have to let go. So if you're working with a koan and your goal is to answer, you know, I must answer this koan by the end of session, you're jinxing yourself, as we say, you know. You're really putting so much pressure on yourself, and then you can't have that open, exploratory mind. You're not trusting anymore, right? I mean, the big mind may or may not give you the answer to your koan by the end of the session, right? That may not be what the big mind has in store for you. You know, it's possible the big mind wants you to work on this a little bit more. You know, and you can say to the big mind, but, you know, my self-respect hinges on my answering this koan, you know, and the big mind doesn't care, you know, about that. So, you know, that in itself is enlightening, right? I mean, you realize, well, you know, it's only an arbitrary cutoff. I mean, if you were driving, there was a guy, this really happened, there was a person who, it doesn't practice with me anymore, but he practiced with me for a number of years. And, you know, remember that this is Buddhism, right? This is supposed to be about compassion. And it was the last day of the session, and he was hoping to come in and give me the answer to his koan. And ahead of him in line was a member of our group who was actually... kind of could be sort of chatty, you know, chatty, and that person went into the Dokusan room and just started chatting away, you know, and it basically burned up a whole bunch of time, you know? And this person is a wonderful person, but could be a bit of the person in Dokusan. It could be kind of a ham, you know? So we're sort of hamming it up, and, you know. Anyway, this person burned up a whole bunch of time, and then there wasn't a chance for this other guy to come into Dokusan. And that guy was furious. He was like hopping mad, you know. In fact, and shortly after that, quit. It's like, so basically he was just like, he was hopping mad. See, now, that's so human, right? We all have that, you know, competitive mindset. But if only he could have seen his own anger, his own competitiveness, his own insecurity, right? You know, he could have, after the sesshin, he could have said, Kurt, before you hit the road, can I just tell you the answer to my koan? And I was, sure, that's great, fantastic, you know. It had become this big symbol in his own mind. You know, this is his, he wanted to hit it, the base is loaded, the, you know, hit it into the stand, and now this chatty Kathy destroyed his chances, right? You know, basically, of doing that. And so his glory was stolen by this person, right? So all of this is good, right? All of this is, this person will figure this out. You know, maybe practicing somewhere else, sooner or later, in some lifetime, this person will see the fear and in his response to these events, right? And be liberated by that. So all of this is just to make the process less mysterious, you know, so it's not a totally mysterious process to you. But I think it doesn't, when I explain it like this, I don't think it makes it less amazing. I think koan training is just the most amazing thing in the world. You know, we are undiscovered continents to ourselves. And even though therapy is a wonderful, wonderful thing, it doesn't really focus on this, you know. I have a friend who is a very distinguished psychotherapist. And this person, she asked me once about Zen, and I was talking to her, and it didn't make any sense to her at all. And I was talking about the unconscious, and I said, "There's the personal unconscious," and she said, "Well, that's the only unconscious there is, right? You know?" And she said it sort of laughingly, like, "Well, what other unconscious could you be talking about?" It's like, "Oh, you don't know." You know, I didn't make her a Zen person, you know, but the personal unconscious is very important, and therapy is wonderful, but there's this other bigger mind that we have that we begin to discover and activate here at Sesshin. And the goal is to produce a person who is an awakened person, and an awakened person means somebody who has no barriers, and who is, you know, basically responding in a compassionate way to all circumstances, you know. So a Buddha is a perfectly, you could say, perfectly compassionate person. That's the goal of our work, is to produce a perfectly compassionate person. There's no human being who is a perfectly compassionate person, but we all take bodhisattva vows at the end of the day. And basically we say, essentially, when we recite that shujo, muhan stuff, that really means, basically, you know, it's the wisdom is infinite, but I will try to learn all of it. You know, suffering is infinite, as a matter of fact, but I will never stop trying to alleviate it. You know, and basically, you know, that's the spirit of those four vows. There's a translation in the sutra book. Basically we're saying, I will never stop practicing until I am awake. And when I'm awake, I will never stop practicing until I have helped all beings free themselves from suffering. So that's the goal. That's what the apps are for, you know. The Raja of an East Indian country invited the 27th Buddhist ancestor, Prajnatara, to a feast. The Raja asked him, "Why don't you read the scriptures?" The ancestor said, "This poor wayfarer doesn't dwell in the realms of body and mind when breathing in, enters Mushin, doesn't get involved in myriad circumstances when breathing out, because possesses wisdom. I always reiterate such a scripture, hundreds, thousands, millions of scrolls. A cloud rhino gazes at the moon, its light engulfing the radiance. A wooden horse romps in spring, swift and unbridled. Under the eyebrows, a pair of cold blue eyes. How can reading scriptures reach the piercing of oxhide? The clear mind produces vast aeons. Heroic power smashes the double enclosure. In the subtle round mouth of the pivot turns the spiritual works. Han Shan forgot the road by which he came. Shurda led him back by the hand. And as it just happens, our lineage is the Han Shan lineage." So Han Shan basically is a great Zen practitioner who lived for many years alone in the mountains with his friend Shurda. And it is a wonderful poems by Han Shan. And he talks about his experience of enlightenment and his joy at practicing the Great Way. And, you know, Han Shan is considered to be one of the great poets of China. These poems are really quite wonderful if you have a chance to read them. His best friend was a person named Shurda, who was supposed to be, you could say, like mildly retarded. So he was a super genius and this mildly retarded person. And they loved each other and were the best friends and constant companions. And they both dwelt in enlightened mind. So...